You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by a WNT colleague, Louis Abad, who is a principal in KPMG's Trade and Customs Tax Practice. Welcome, Lou.
Oh, good morning, Liz. I'm happy to be here and talk about tariffs today.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. And so, yes, today we're going to talk about tariffs. Not a topic typically bank tax departments spend a lot of time on, but let's put this in context. We are facing a tax fiscal cliff with the expiration of the TCJA tax cuts. And there's a lot of chatter around tariffs as potential revenue raisers for future tax legislation. So yes, we're hearing a lot about this. We certainly heard a lot about tariffs on the campaign trail, even more post-election. I believe there's a quote from Donald Trump that says, "To me, the most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff. It's my favorite word." So I expect we're going to hear even more about tariffs in the future. So I invited Lou on today because I want to discuss more about how tariffs actually work. How are they assessed? Lou, I don't know much about it. Consider us newbies in the audience. So can you walk us through the fundamentals and give us a little bit about tariffs 101?
Yeah, absolutely, Liz. I think it's important because we heard a lot of things on the campaign trail this past election, and I think it's important to dispel some myths. I think the first one is that tariffs are not paid by foreign countries. They're actually paid by U.S. companies who act as importers of record on their customs declarations. So the way it typically works is that tariffs are assessed on imported goods, physical goods. They're not assessed on services or digital information, for example. It's physical goods that are coming across the border from a foreign country into the U.S. customs territory. And with every shipment, the importer of record has to file a customs entry, which is the formal paperwork or electronic information to customs for them to assess the relevant duties and tariffs on the applicable goods. Now, when the importer of record files the entry, you might want to look at that almost like a tax return. It has a lot of information that will allow customs to properly and accurately assess how much customs duties is assessed. For example, who's the consignee, who's the manufacturer, what type of goods are being imported. But there's three real critical elements that are important to assess tariffs. The first is the Harmonized Tariff System classification, or the HTS classification. There's over 10,000 different classifications for different goods, and the importers has to determine which classification applies to their goods. So for example, footwear. You might have footwear with rubber soles. That'll have a different classification than footwear with leather soles. Passenger vehicles and cargo vehicles will have different classifications. And that classification code will have the correlating duty rate for that particular good. So it's really important that you get the classification right. So that's the first step. Then the second step for assessing tariffs is the country of origin, which is typically where the goods are manufactured or where a substantial transformation of those goods happens in the foreign country. And this is important because some of the tariffs apply specifically to goods from certain countries. For example, we saw President Trump during his first administration impose tariffs on Chinese goods specifically. So if your good was produced in China, it was probably subject to these tariffs, right? So country of origin is really important. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, I think. And the country of origin is also not where the goods are shipped from. Sometimes that's a misconception. Well, my goods are produced in China, but I'm shipping them to Mexico first and then transshipping them to the U.S. That does not change the country of origin. The goods are still Chinese. So it's not where you ship or export from. It's where the goods are produced. And then finally, the third piece of information that's really critical is the customs value. Typically, that's the invoice price. You know, if you're dealing with related parties, there's specific arm's length rules that have to be met that are different than the OECD or Section 482 of the Internal Revenue Code. There are specific customs arm's length rules that have to be met in order to determine the customs value. And honestly, I could spend a whole hour talking just about customs value and how you determine that. So those are the three critical elements: classification, country of origin, and customs value. And it's really important that you get those three right. And that'll tell you then what duty rates are applicable not only the general duty rates, but any special punitive tariffs that President Trump might impose like he did during his first administration.
So let's pause there for a second. So we need to understand what the item is, where it's produced, what its value is. And all of that goes into determining the amount of tariff?
Yes, because tariffs are usually on an ad valorem basis, right? So the value is important because that'll form the basis on which you apply the rate. And as I mentioned, the country of origin is critical because, you know, the tariffs might vary depending on where the goods are produced or what country they're from.
So let's stick with that for a second, because how are tariffs imposed? How do we even get to the point where we know that something is imposed on a particular item from a particular country?
Right. So let's start with the general duty rates. Those are in the Harmonized Tariff System code that I mentioned. You know, there's over 10,000 codes, as I indicated. So you'd have to look through the code for your particular product. There's a column one and a column two. The column one will include the general duty rate. And if it's subject to any free trade agreements, it'll tell you that you get a special rate, you know, that might be lower than the general rate. And then the column two is really for non-WTO member countries. So it might be a little bit higher. And so if you don't have what's called permanent normal trade relations status, you would be in column two. But if you're a WTO member and you have PNTR, you're in column one and you either get the general rate, or if you have a free trade agreement that's applicable because it's, let's say, for example, the goods are produced in either Mexico or Canada and they qualify for the USMCA free trade agreement, they might get a duty-free treatment for that good. So you really have to look at the harmonized tariff system to determine what the rates are. So that's the general rate.
So what I'm hearing is tariffs aren't new. We've got an entire system for how they're imposed depending on what the item is. And yet now we seem to be hearing a lot more about it. Is this just in terms of new tariffs?
President Trump, during his first administration, you know, considers himself the tariff man. And during this past election, he emphasized that he intends to use tariff as a foreign policy tool. And so we anticipate that we're going to see President Trump, you know, implement some additional tariffs. And he has this authority under various statutes. So, you know, over the last couple of decades, Congress has delegated a lot of its authority to levy tariffs and regulate international commerce to the executive branch, because the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, gives Congress the authority to levy tariffs, regulate international commerce. But Congress has delegated this back to the president. And a lot of this happened during the Cold War, because the belief was that the executive branch and the president should have additional tools to influence foreign policy, and tariffs and trade policy was one avenue that the president could use to influence foreign policy. So there's various statutes that the president could invoke to trigger new tariffs, but they all require like special underlying conditions to exist in order for the president to invoke those tariffs. And we saw him do that during the first administration with some of these special tariffs.
So, Lou, what are some of the tariffs that the president has said he may impose? And can you give us a sense of under what authority that would happen?
Sure. So on the campaign trail, President Trump indicated he would impose tariffs on Mexico, Canada, China. And more recently, he got a little more specific. He said he would impose 25% tariffs on all goods from Canada and Mexico. And the reason being because of the border crisis and also because of the fentanyl imports. And he also said he would impose an additional 10% tariffs on all goods from China. And he pointed also to the fact that a lot of the fentanyl precursors are coming from China. So those are kind of the reasons he indicated why he would impose these tariffs. He also said he would impose a 10% global tariff on all goods coming into the United States to level the playing field, because he believes that the U.S. has lower tariffs than other countries. And also we have trade deficits with other countries. So this is one way in which he might try to level that playing field. And he also more recently said he would impose a 100% tariff on all goods from BRICS countries if they stopped using U.S. dollar as their currency reserve. So he said a lot of these things on the campaign trail, and whether he can do them or not really depends on the statute or the lever that he pulls. As I indicated, Congress has delegated a lot of these authority to impose tariffs to the executive branch. And there's a bunch of statutes. One of them, for example, is Section 201 of the Trade Act of 1974, which is called the safeguard measure tariff. So these safeguard tariffs are generally put in place to protect the domestic industry when they're being harmed by excessive import volumes. And we saw President Trump impose these tariffs during his first administration to protect solar panels and large residential washers. The intent was that by putting these tariffs and quotas in place, it would protect those domestic industries. The president also has a lever to pull under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which is called the National Security Tariff. And we saw the president impose these tariffs on aluminum and steel during his first administration, 25% tariffs on steel, 10% tariffs on aluminum. And again, this is because the statute allows the president to invoke these tariffs when import volumes are at such a level or being imported under such circumstances that they present a threat on national security. And so we saw President Trump invoke that during his first administration. And there's also Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which is considered an unfair trade practices tariff. And this is imposed on any country that is undertaking some kind of unfair trade practice, is violating a trade agreement, is taking discriminatory trade action against the U.S. And we saw President Trump use this lever as well during his first administration on China, in which he imposed tariffs on about $350 billion worth of Chinese goods. And the underlying reason for the tariffs was that China was alleged to be infringing on IP rights, was forcing U.S. companies to transfer technology and IP to Chinese companies, which tend to be Chinese owned. And so the first Trump administration thought this was an unfair trade practice and imposed these tariffs, which ranged from, you know, from 5% to up to 50% in some cases.
Okay, so it sounds like Congress has delegated a bunch of authority to the executive branch, but to impose the tariffs, it needs to be tied to something like protecting a specific industry, a national security concern, an unfair trade practice, et cetera. So are there specific reasons or ties from the things that have been proposed or talked about on the campaign trail to any of these reasons for imposition?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that the reasons that Trump has indicated in his Truth Social posts on tariffs don't really tie to the tariffs, the tariff statutes I just mentioned. And so the belief is that he might seek to pull additional levers, which he did not use during his first administration, one of them being the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And this is a statute that gives the president broad authority when there's a national emergency. So if the president declares a national emergency, he can take any action that is necessary, including trade action and the imposition of tariffs. Now, the president did threaten this during his first administration against Mexico, where he threatened a 5% tariff on Mexico because of the border crisis. But then Mexico responded with imposing additional security measures on the southern border. And then they implemented the remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers while their asylum process played out on the U.S. side. They remained on the Mexican side. And President Trump was satisfied with those concessions and never imposed it. But it was believed that he intended to impose a 5% tariff under the IEEPA statute. So when you look at the reasons he's given this time, the border crisis, fentanyl and drugs, illicit drugs, it's believed that he might be looking to use IEEPA to implement these tariffs because they don't really fit into the Safeguard Measures Act, Section 201, or the Unfair Trade Practices Act under Section 301, even national security, Section 232, because it's not about imports of specific products that are harming U.S. national security. It's something broader, such as the Mexican border crisis and fentanyl. So it's believed that the president might be looking to use IEEPA, a lever that really has never been used before to impose tariffs under any president. There is some precedent under the Trading with the Enemy Act, which is the predecessor statute to IEEPA. President Nixon used that to impose a 10% tariff across the board. So there is some precedent for using kind of this national emergency pretext to impose tariffs under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And that, by the way, was upheld by an appellate level court. So the president might be looking at this and saying, well, IEEPA is the successor statute to that. So there's some precedent for you to be able to use that.
And can you talk to us about timing? Like, how long does it take to enact something? How quickly could something get into place?
Yeah, so it depends, again, which lever and which pretext is used. So, for example, I believe that on China, the president can act relatively quickly because there is already an underlying Section 301 tariff measure in place. And so the president can modify that and either expand the scope of products or increase the rates, the tariff rates on China without a lengthy investigation. Because the way it normally works under Section 201, 232, and 301 is that there is an agency that is assigned that needs to undertake an investigation, issue a report, make a proposal to the president or a recommendation, and then the president has to act on that. And that typically can take up to 12 to 13 months. During his first administration, most of those actions took between 8 and 11 months. So there's a lengthy process. But for Section 301, I don't believe that he would need to undergo another lengthy investigation on China. He could just modify the existing one. So that's something he can act relatively soon within the first 100 days. I also think that under IEEPA, there is no investigative process. There is no need for congressional approval. If he declares a national emergency on day one, he can impose tariffs relatively quickly as well. Any other actions under Section 232 or Section 301, for example, I think that the president would have to initiate a new investigation with the respective agency, and it could take, like I said, up to 12 to 13 months.
So, Lou, how do some of these tariffs impact companies?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. The most obvious is obviously the higher tariff cost will increase the cost of goods, and you know, whether they pass that on to their clients or distributors, it's something that they have to consider and contemplate on how to handle the increased cost. But there's other secondary impacts too on the importers. So for example, when an importer brings in goods, they also have to file a surety bond to make sure that they can cover the payment and liability on the tariffs. So obviously higher tariffs mean higher surety bond amounts because the potential liability for duty increases. And typically this is calculated as a percentage of the total duty liability. So we'll probably see, you know, higher premiums for the surety bonds. Also, we might start to see bond insufficiency notices and delays and corresponding fines from customs if the importer does not have enough coverage in their bond for the higher tariffs. And then also it presents a strain on cash flow, both in terms of paying the tariffs and also, you know, there might be the need to provide additional collateral to secure the higher bonds. So there's a lot of, you know, primary and secondary effects, but the primary one is obviously the higher tariff cost means higher cost of goods sold.
And what are companies doing to prepare for potentially higher tariffs?
Yeah, so there's a few things that can be done. The first is really making sure that you analyze your trade data to model out how the tariffs could impact you under the various scenarios that might play out, and review your supply chains to see, are you sourcing from places and countries that are likely to get hit with the tariffs? You know, companies are really looking at supply chain diversification, either sourcing in different countries, and manufacturers are also looking at country of origin alternatives, seeing, can I modify my supply chain or my manufacturing process so that my good is no longer considered a product of China? And sometimes, you know, this means moving some of your operations to another country. And we saw this during the first Trump administration, where a lot of companies moved their operations from China to Vietnam, for example, or to Mexico or Malaysia in order to change the different country of origin. And so this presents an opportunity because it's more art than science, to be honest, in determining whether substantial transformation happens in another country. And customs looks at many different factors based on case law and rulings, et cetera. So there's an opportunity there to really shift the origin of your products so that you're not paying these high tariffs. But there's also pitfalls, because a lot of times we've seen companies say, well, I'm just going to move my last step assembly operation from China to another country. But when you look at all the factors, you know, the costs are primarily from China, the most essential components that give the finished good its functionality are from China. And so the good ends up being in China, even though they move these operations. So it's really critical that you get that country of origin analysis right. Some companies are also stockpiling goods before Trump takes office. So they're importing goods in advance of the tariffs and increasing their inventories at the beginning of the year and not waiting for the tariffs to take place. Companies also reviewing and renegotiating their supply and distribution agreements, including what we say is a tariff majeure clause, so that it discusses how to share the tariff burden if excessive tariffs come into place. Who will bear the burden for that? Do they renegotiate the price, or do they trigger new discussions on pricing? So these are things that companies are trying to do with respect to their agreements. And there's also various tariff mitigation strategies that exist that perhaps under the previous environment where we were dealing with maybe 5% tariffs didn't have a great return on investment. But now that we're talking about 15, 20, 25% tariffs, the return on investment increases and is enhanced. So it makes sense to kind of dust off some of those tariff mitigation strategies and reconsider them and see whether the cost-benefit analysis is different under the new environment. And finally, I would just say keep an eye out for exclusions during the first Trump administration. Section 232 and Section 301 tariffs, for example, had an exclusion process where companies can apply for an exclusion. And usually these exclusions were granted if there was like economic hardship on a particular company, let's say because they couldn't source anywhere but from China or from a country that had these high tariffs. So there really wasn't any opportunity to modify their sourcing consistent with the underlying policy, which was kind of to decouple from China, for example. So, keep an eye out for that. There might be additional exclusion processes under the new tariffs as well.
Great. That's interesting and some good practical considerations. And I think this may directly, more likely indirectly impact a lot of banks, but I think this is interesting also in the context of understanding what might be impacting banks' customers for sure. Lou, I have learned so much from you today. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights. And I really want to have you back as we watch what unfolds both on the tariff side, but also on any tax legislation or budget reconciliation. And we can see how tariffs might be used to help pay for some of that. Thank you so much for talking us through this topic today. I needed the primer and you delivered. So I'll be very interested to see how things unfold in Washington over the next month.
Just great. Thank you for having me on. And I'm hoping this is helpful to everyone.
Absolutely. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.